What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are a progressive politics show broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on UBC's Point Grey campus. I'm with my co-host, Nitai.
Happy to be here.
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And for today's show, we are speaking truth to power about missing and murdered Indigenous women, decriminalization, Julian Assange, and the DNC. But before we get to all that, I would like to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh nations. And rather than keeping this as a tokenistic gesture to the Indigenous peoples of Canada, as is generally done on UBC's campus, we will keep the Indigenous struggle for self-determination and justice at the forefront of our consciousness. We will begin this show and every show until there's justice for Indigenous people talking about colonialism. So this report came across my desk recently. This is the Red Women Rising report written by Carol Murray Martin and Harsha Walia. So the title again, Red Women Rising, Indigenous Women Survivors in Vancouver's Downtown East Side. So Nitai, you could put that mic right in front of your face.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, cool. Hey, welcome, Nitai.
Thanks. Happy
this,
to be here.
This is Nitai's first time on air, so welcome. This is awesome. I'm very excited to bring him out. Nitai is a very, very smart political person, so I'm very excited to talk to him today. So Red Women Rising, this is situated in the downtown Vancouver's downtown east side.
I think it's worth mentioning that they didn't write it. It's more like a compilation of a bunch of like reports from other women.
Yes, that's a very good point. So a little background on this. So the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, that was established in 1978. The Downtown Eastside Women's Center provides support to women and their children through a drop-in center and a low-barrier emergency night shelter for all self-identified women who face homelessness and violence. The Downtown Eastside Women's Center provides basic necessities such as hot meals, laundry, phone access, bathrooms, and showers. The Downtown Eastside Women's Center also offers specialized advocacy through victim services, housing providing outreach, health teams, and legal advocates. Over 70% of women who access the Downtown Eastside Women's Center identify as Indigenous. A vast majority of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the Downtown Eastside access the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. A vast majority of missing and murdered Indigenous women in the... Oh yeah, I already said that. 10 years ago, Downtown Eastside Women's Center file showed 129 women missing from the area over 9 years, while police statistics were fewer than 50 names. So that's a little background on the Women's Center. This report put together compiles stories from 113 Indigenous women survivors of violence and 50 non-Indigenous women who are friends or street families of Indigenous women who are missing, have overdosed, or died from violence in the Downtown Eastside. So just like Nitai was saying, this is not just written by the two authors, Carol Mary Martin and Harshwalia. It is actually the stories of over 100 people, over 129 women, 128 women. And this is super important because, you know, we don't need, people like more men trying to, you know, or experts coming into research. You know, these people are experts in their own lives. You know, you don't need anyone else telling them what life is like in the Downtown Eastside. So what is the Downtown Eastside? Well, that is one of the poorest postal codes in North America. During the 90s, there was the only place on earth that had higher HIV rates was in Africa. There was a 100% hepatitis B infection rate. So every single person that living in the Downtown Eastside had Hep B for a while. And that just shows you it's not just people who, and this is really unfortunate, but a thing that comes from growing up in Vancouver is that this neighborhood is often taught to people, or you go on a field trip by and you'd be like, hey kids, this is where you end up if you make poor decisions. And this report kind of blows that out of the water, because what this is a structural violence against people. This is institutionalized poverty. This is where excess labor, excess people kind of get thrown to the wolves. And this, what's so great about the Downtown Eastside Women's Center and this report, kind of shows you the resiliency of people to do the thing that, you know, all that capitalist propaganda tells you to do, which is pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Except they're not just pulling themselves up, they're pulling everyone up around them. They're building actual community, they're protecting each other, providing services for everybody. And I think that's just really incredible, and it's really important to kind of, you know, give them a lot of love for everything they do out there, doing it for decades and with no help from the state, which we will get to later in the report. So this is a over 200 page report, so there's so much to get through, but unfortunately, we can only pick through the executive summary. And reading through the executive summary, it reads, violence against Indigenous women, girls, trans, and Two-Spirit people is the most pressing human rights issue in Canada today. Numerous international bodies have pushed Canada to eliminate violence against Indigenous women and girls. Indigenous women and girls in Canada have been murdered or have gone missing at a rate 4 times higher than the rate of representation of Indigenous women in the population in Canada. Indigenous women's rate of violent victimization is double that of Indigenous men, nearly triple that of non-Indigenous women, and more than triple that of non-Indigenous men. Two-spirit and trans people are violently victimized nearly 5 times as often. Wow. Those are some pretty shocking statistics.
And it just shows like such a perfect example of intersectionality.
Yes. So you can see the intersection of being a woman and being Indigenous and how that leads to really horrible, violent consequences in being part of our settler colonial society. So the report goes on. In the Downtown Eastside, where approximately 8,000 women live and work, incidents of violence are double the rates of the rest of the city, and 16% of reported sexual assaults in the whole city occur in this one neighborhood. In a Downtown Eastside women's safety audit, 87% of women reported feeling unsafe, and 48% of women experienced violence within the last 2 years. Settler colonialism intentionally targets Indigenous women in order to destroy families, sever the connection to land-based practices and economies, and devastate relational governance of Indigenous nations. Indigenous women's and Two-Spirit people's role as decision-makers and holders of traditional knowledge, and their role in matriarchal governance through house groups and clan systems in many nations, was disrupted through colonization. The doctrine of discovery and the myth of terra nullius, or if you're not fluent in Latin, like I am obviously not, means unoccupied land, are racist legal political frameworks that still underpin Canadian institutions through, for example, the false assertion of crown title over Indigenous lands. So a lot to unpack there. Nitai, do you have any thoughts on anything that was kind of brought up about the safety of the Downtown Eastside or settler colonialism?
It's exactly what you'd expect after all this oppression and poverty in these communities. Why would they expect them to get better without any help?
Yeah, it just shows the larger structure, which is unfortunately our entire nation state, is leading to these really horrible statistics of violence. And you know, the authors really pin it down to the settler colonial project, which is removing all the indigenous people from the land and then replacing them with European settlers. So that's why, you know, we're all here that are people who are non-indigenous. You know, that's why we're, shocker, you know, that's why we're all here. And, you know, I really appreciate the point about destroying families and the connection to the land-based practices and economies. So, you know, that's, yeah, and we'll get to that later in the report about how exactly the state, you know, intervenes to destroy the families. But specifically, the land-based practices and economies, I think, is very interesting to talk about because, you know, look at the climate, you know, emergency that we're dealing with and how, you know, we have a capital-based, you know, economy and practices where it's about how much money can you make out of, you know, exchanging commodities, you know, selling crap more or less and, you know, exploiting people to do so versus, you know, indigenous ways of life, which was basically made on, you know, living off the land and maintaining the land and keeping that, you know, relationship intact rather than focusing on how much profit you can extract.
Yeah,
so I thought it was very interesting. Every Indigenous woman in the Downtown Eastside Women's Center membership has also been embroiled in the child welfare system at some point in her life. That's pretty shocking. Every single woman.
100%.
100%. Today, there are three times more Indigenous children forcibly removed from their parents and placed into foster care than at the height of the residential school era. Indigenous children and youth in BC are 15 times more likely to be in the care of Ministry of Child and Family Development than their non-Indigenous counterparts. The rate of investigations of Indigenous children is 4.2 times the rate of non-Indigenous investigations, and Indigenous families are investigated for poverty-related neglect at 8 times the rate of non-Indigenous families.
So it's like exactly... It's just like a way to rebrand residential schools.
Yes, it is. It is completely a rebranding of residential schools. We covered this months and months, almost a year ago at this point, of how in British Columbia they're discussing the foster care situation for Indigenous children and Indigenous people. How it's, you know, basically the 60 scoop continued because there's families getting broken apart to be put into this ministry, even though that the money it took to put together the foster family was less money than it would require to, you know, to bring these people out of poverty. So, for example, so they mentioned in this report, poverty-related neglect. So they'll pay a family 10, 20 grand to take this Indigenous child. Well, why don't you give 10, 20 grand to the Indigenous family to take them out of poverty? It's just crazy. You know, how could you say it was anything other than you're looking for an excuse because you got the money?
Destroy the family.
Yeah, and that's what it. And you know, bringing it back to the violence against women point, Indigenous families and women are so important because you know that's what reproduces indigeneity, right? So you know, Indigenous women give birth to Indigenous kids.
Yeah,
you know, Indigenous parents, you know, elders, mothers, you know, fathers. They teach Indigenous culture, Indigenous languages, the Indigenous way of life, and they reproduce Indigenous society.
Yeah.
So this is really gross, but it seems that the settler colonial logic is, you know, in order to wipe out indigeneity, you need to go after families because that's where the culture is reproduced.
It's the most effective way to do it.
Yeah, and then, you know, and if you're going to get really, you know, vulgar with it, you know, just destroy women, right? The most common cause of death for Indigenous women is physical violence. 2018, yeah. You know, 2019, that's the most common way for them to die. So, you know, it's unfortunately just the logic taken to its conclusions.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really gross. Back to the point about families. 120 youth died, in or receiving services from the provincial child welfare system in the year 2016. The Provincial Representative for Children and Youth's office receives 200 critical injury and death reports for children and youth in care every month. The connection between the child welfare system and violence against Indigenous girls is stark. Indigenous girls in the BC child welfare system are 4 times more likely to be the victims of sexual violence than non-Indigenous girls. Over 60% of children and youth who report sexual violence in government care are Indigenous girls. When they become adults, Indigenous survivors of childhood sexual abuse are 10 times more likely to be sexually assaulted.
And This is the same government that's obsessed with reconciliation. And
obsessed with feminism, obsessed with reconciliation. And look what's happening in British Columbia. Please. This is a progressive, you know, air quotes, progressive province.
Yeah.
You know, this is where Justin Trudeau taught drama class. How is this happening in this province where you were such a great teacher, Prime Minister Trudeau?
It's very embarrassing.
It's I would, you know, and it's crazy, and you know, and I make this point, and I would love to hear your point about it. So you brought up the point earlier about residential schools. That's really poignant, because if you think about it, it's like, rather than having the RCMP take the kids forcibly and then take them to this school, it's just, you know, we're going to take you away from your family because you're poor, even though we have the money to make you not poor, and we give you to this family where you're going to die or get hurt. So
it sounds like residential schools with more steps.
Yeah, residential schools with more steps. That's great. Okay, I'm gonna coin that term. Thank you. Thank you, Nitai. And here's another one. So I think we have a crazy country because, you know, we have a current genocide going on. We've had, you know, the more, like, out there, crazy, in-your-face genocide of actually just starving them to death, killing them point-blank or at gunpoint and the like. And, you know, how do we deal with it as a society, right? So, yeah. You know, in Germany, what happened after the Holocaust, right? You know, there's Holocaust memorials everywhere, right? And that's great. That's exactly what they need to do. They took Auschwitz-Birkenau and turned it into a museum. Every, you know, German school child goes there to learn about fascism because, you know, that's what you should learn about. It's like, you know, this is, you want to talk about, you know, far-right politics? Well, this is what it turns into.
Yeah, I'm like scared that Canada's going to turn into kind of a Japan who just doesn't educate their students on residential schools and all the atrocities they committed in the past.
I think we're somewhere between Japan, which is just, you know, denial.
Yeah.
And we're somewhere between Germany, which is, I would think, is actually a really good model of being like, you know, this is what it is.
Yeah.
We kind of view settler colonialism as this kind of like, you know, and I think it might be because of the influence of our southern neighbor, the United States, where, you know, we stumble into war, right? You know, you know, accidentally do things. It's never like, you know, the logical conclusion or this, you know, even if it is in plain writing, like some of John A. McDonald's really, really horrible quotes talking about breaking the indigenous child and stuff like that. So they're very explicit about it. Yet, however, you know, we look back at this history as like, oh, what a blunder.
Yeah. And also, there's a lot of people who still see this as justified. It's like, oh, countries would conquer each other all the time. Why is this any different?
Yeah. And it's like, well, what if this wasn't a country and instead of conquering them, we exterminated them? And then every time they tried to have a potluck, we arrested them. And it's kind of like, that's not really, you know, and we're still occupying them. So that's a war crime. So I just feel like, maybe this is my really stark prediction, but due to the fact that it's just so, and that if we actually accepted that, yeah, this is actually, you know, on its face and by every other measure, a war crime, our entire country, due to the fact that it is such, we can never really grapple with that. What do you think about that, Nitai?
Yeah, and Canada always talks about like how it was a big mistake and how we should make up for it. But then we
reconcile.
Then we see something like Trudeau buy the Kinder Morgan pipeline, just keep trying to like violate indigenous land. It's the culture is supposed to be shifting, but how could the culture shift if the government just keeps doing the same thing over and over again?
Those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And
It,
folks. That's basically the entire Canadian nation state and ideology. So we're going to have to take a short commercial break, but we'll be right back.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or f*** with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips. But are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy, a watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate, remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What's this Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Sunday.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you out.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm with my co-host, Nitai.
Hey.
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and we'll just wrap up the conclusion of the executive summary of Red Women Rising, Indigenous Women Survivors in Vancouver's Downtown East Side. This is a report compiled from stories of 113 Indigenous women survivors of violence and 50 non-Indigenous women who are friends or street families of Indigenous women who are missing, have overdosed, or died from violence in the Downtown East Side. The report was put together by Carol Marie Martin and Harsha Walia, and due to the amazing work of the Downtown East Side Women's Center, and also financially supported by your UBC AMS resource group. So shouts out resource groups. Nitai, you're a part of the resource group, so shouts out to you.
I'm the discussion manager.
Discussion facilitator
for the SGC.
Discussion facilitator for the SGC. So thank you for supporting them and signing off on that financial resource. Really appreciate it. In conclusion to this report, Indigenous women's overrepresentation in statistics on poverty, homelessness, child apprehensions, police street checks, incarceration, opioid overdose fatalities, and health inequities are part of an infrastructure of gendered colonial violence. Colonial state practices target women for removal from Indigenous lands, tear children from their families, enforce impoverishment, and manufacture the conditions for dehumanization. The 200, read that folks, 200 recommendations, and this is part of a 216 report. So yeah, they got a lot of info and a lot of stuff in there for you. In this report, to end state and societal violence are based on three core principles. So core principle number one. Violence against Indigenous women and girls is a violation of inherent constitutional and internationally protected Indigenous rights. Implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, or UNDRIP, at all levels of government, assertion of Indigenous title over lands and jurisdiction over lawmaking, and restoration of collective Indigenous women's rights and governance is the only meaningful way to end this violence. Nita, any thoughts on that? I think the university that we're on, that is on stolen Musqueam land, and the student union that is built, student union building that we're broadcasting from, and the student union that takes our money every year and does nothing with it, except hold lavish parties for itself, that needs to adopt UNDRIP.
Yeah. That would be really important.
Indigenous issues are always hot button at the school. Everyone, you know, falls over themselves trying to say how much they love Indigenous people. Adopt UNDRIP. Very simple.
Yeah.
You know, they don't ask much. You know, you don't have to state how you're a white settler. We can tell you're white. It's okay. Everyone can see that you're a white person. Yep. And clearly you're a settler. So why don't you just adopt UNDRIP? Be a good settler. Number two. Increased state enforcement alone cannot eliminate violence against Indigenous women and girls because structural violence is connected to individual acts of male violence. A comprehensive plan to end violence against Indigenous women must address socioeconomic factors, including equitable access to and self-determination over land, culture, language, housing, childcare, income, security, employment, education, and physical, mental, and spiritual health. Wow. That was much needed. And the funniest thing about these things is that it's not just for Indigenous women. This would help everybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, I view, unfortunately, you know, Indigenous women seem to be and two-spirit and trans folks seem to be at the bottom of our society, and yet what their needs are is everyone else's needs.
Yeah,
so.
And it's not a simple fix, like considering that the Canadian government was like strategically invented the criminal justice system to like secure and maintain the settler sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Like you do need it's not just throwing money at the issue.
Yeah, it can't, and it can't just be more cops.
Yeah,
certainly not. Considering we didn't get a chance to talk.
No one wants that.
Yeah, no one wants that. The Indigenous women do not feel safe around the police. This is a great statistic I want to get here.
And there's also like a very good reason for them to have a lot of distrust in the government.
Yeah, sorry, we just got to take we got to do a little bit of cop bashing because that's a mainstay of this show. Sorry from the report. I'll go through really quickly. Another barrier to ending violence is the failure of the entire criminal justice system to take violence against Indigenous women and girls seriously, as detailed in the final report on the Missing Women Commission of Inquiry. The Vancouver Police Department, VPD, they tased my good friend Jamil Moore Williams. That's great. Great work, fellas. The boys in blue. Failed to prevent and protect Indigenous women from violence and failed to diligently investigate violence when it occurred. In a downtown Eastside women's safety audit, only 15% of 157 women said they would go to the police if they felt unsafe. Many Indigenous women enter the criminal justice system because of their experiences as survivors of violence. Rather than receiving protection, the criminal justice system constructs Indigenous women as risks to be contained, makes Indigenous women unsafe, and exacerbates Indigenous women's inequality. So there you go, folks. The cops, more cops would actually make the problem worse. So that can't be it. In fact, well, we should probably get back to, I think the third point kind of hits the nail on the head of exactly what needs to happen. Point three, Indigenous women in the downtown Eastside are not silent victims or stereotypes. Indigenous women in the downtown Eastside come from diverse nations and families and have unique stories and dreams. Indigenous women in the downtown Eastside are all leaders who contribute countless hours to the community and will never stop fighting for justice. Any policy services and solutions must be based on Indigenous women's collective input and leadership. I think that's probably the best point there, and I think something that people need to chew on more. So, you know, it can't just collective input and leadership does not mean, you know, oh, we held a town hall meeting and the check, you know. Why can't, you know, our state and, you know, any other political movement that's happening, you know, actually just take the input of these people and make that into the policy
and give them some kind of power.
Yeah, and then be, you know, and then if they're unhappy with it, you know, then we change, you know, and then we get recalled to do better because, like, you know, isn't that the point of the government? For the people, by the people?
This isn't, like, obviously isn't working. We need to try something new.
It's, and, you know, these things they're talking about, physical, mental health, and spiritual health. Yeah, no one's doing well in those areas. It's not just Indigenous women. So, you know, these people that are, you know, big bootlickers out here, very happy with the status quo. Like, you know, it's not, it's failing you. You know, give up. You know, take the boot out of your mouth already, people. Like, wake up. You know, these Indigenous women, they may look different than you, and they're not, you know, white guys, but, you know, they still, shocker, human beings have the same needs. And, you know, the way that deal with those human beings is the same way that all human beings should be dealt with. But there I go off on, you know, wishing too much out of people. So any other thoughts, Nitai, on this amazing report?
I would just recommend everyone... like, everyone should read it, and I'd obviously want the government to take some input from it, at least.
That would be nice. Yeah. That would be nice. I'm pretty sure it was on the Liberal platform, so that would be nice. Also, if you try to find it on CBC, you can't, because it's a really pathetic 200-word summary of this 200-page article. So, I mean, report, so... thank you, CBC, for doing none of the reporting. But of course, you know, we can't expect the state broadcaster to do that. So
yeah.
We're going to take this time to transition to another BC-related issue and some really exciting news, actually, coming from BC's top doctor. So this is an article in the Georgia Strait written by a friend of the show, Travis Lupik. The headline reads, BC should decriminalize drug possession to reduce fentanyl deaths. Province's top doctor outlines a plan. A major report by the provincial health officer recommends BC bypass Ottawa and drop criminal penalties for people caught with drugs. So this was posted on April 24th, 2019. The article reads, BC's top health official has issued a strongly worded report that could set the province on a radical new path for how it responds to drug use and addiction. This provincial health officer special report examines the criminalization of people who use drugs in BC, Canada, and beyond, and based on existing evidence, offers a single recommendation. Decriminalization of people who use drugs, it reads. The document was drafted by Dr. Bonnie Henry, a senior government official who's tasked with improving the overall health of the province. It recommends that BC remove criminal penalties for the personal possession of illicit narcotics, including hard drugs like cocaine, heroin, and fentanyl. That would mean someone caught with a small amount of drugs would not go to jail or be subject to lesser criminal penalties such as probation. Anyone found with a large amount of drugs, enough to suggest they are involved in drug trafficking, would remain subject to criminal proceedings. The report does not, and I repeat, does not recommend that BC legalize hard drugs, which would go one step further than decriminalization, bringing supply under the control of government regulators. There is a widespread global recognition that the failed war on drugs and the resulting criminalization and stigmatization of people who use drugs has not reduced drug use, but instead has increased health harms, the document reads. Engagement with the criminal justice system exposes nonviolent, otherwise law-abiding people to a great deal of harms that they would otherwise not experience. The societal stigma associated with drug use leads many to use drugs alone and hidden, increasing their risk of dying, it adds. So there's a lot there. Wow. I think, you know, right off the top, I'm going to say this is a great move by Dr. Bonnie Henry, and it would keep the province healthy, which is what we're looking for. It's not about, you know, upholding my beliefs about, you know, I want people to just be strong enough to say no to drugs.
Yeah, this is I was having discussions with people about this, and then people, like, if someone uses drugs, they're just completely dehumanized, and, like, they're beyond repair. But then they never look at, like, empirical evidence of places that actually do this. So somewhere like Portugal, I think it was in 2001, they mm-hmm. decriminalized drugs, and the amount of people using drugs, like, per capita was about the same, but the death to drug use was way lower, and way lower than almost anywhere in Europe.
So, and it's not that, you know, Portugal went through like a 70th Industrial Revolution or anything. It's just that they stopped using the cops to deal with what is very obviously a health problem.
Yeah.
A health problem, people, not a criminal problem, a health problem. Yeah, so, Nitai, obviously, you brought up an interesting point about people who dehumanize people who use drugs. How do you feel about whenever it's a rich person or a person of high social status? Do they get dehumanized, like, or do they get immortalized into stupid movies like Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah, I just see, like, and I don't remember which celebrity had, like, a cocaine overdose, but then people are just talking about, like, how amazing she is that she survived and she's in rehab, but then there's, like, people all over in, like, much worse environments where they can't get help, just dying from this, and no one cares.
No, and in fact, they're demonized for it. They're the problem. They're the perpetrators. They're not victims like rich people or white people for that mind. So, yeah. Well, the war on drugs. So there's the war on drugs. What is the war on drugs? The war on drugs is is the criminal justice system being brought in to deal with the quote unquote drug problem. So drug problem being people who are using drugs, people who are dying from drugs, and people who are selling drugs. So this was mentioned in the in the article as a failed war on drugs. So, but before we understand how it failed, you know, it's probably good to understand how it started. So this is my favorite quote to bring up. I love saying this. This made me absolutely no friends in my sociology, drugs, and society class because it kind of ended, I don't care that I like dunking on people, okay? I don't care that I like dunking on the fascist kid who supported Duterte in the class. It made me feel good. It made me feel good to say this. So I'm going to say it again. Former Nixon, President Richard Nixon, domestic policy chief John Ehrlichman, so this is a quote from him, quote, "The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. We knew that we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public," "but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about drugs? Of course we did." So this is from the people who created the war on drugs, the famous Nixon speech about the war on drugs and how drugs are a scourge. So this is the guy who came up with it from the horse's mouth. This is not Vladimir Lenin's take on drugs. This is not Che Guevara on drugs, you know. This is not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders on drugs. This is the Nixon domestic policy chief, people. I don't want to debate anyone on this anymore.
Yeah, it's just, and there's just so much history with the U.S. like intentionally screwing over usually like black communities, like, and how crack cocaine, crack cocaine in black community. It was like very intentional. The CIA orchestrated most of it. It's
fast. We need to do another show about just drugs. We'll do a special. Remind me next year for the 420 episode, okay. And we'll do it all on drugs. Maybe the host will be on drugs. Who knows? We'll find out next year. But we'll do it all about drugs because it's just such a great topic to dissect because it's just so in your face how. Yeah. It's not about people. It's just about punishing people, or it's for securing political objectives, such as getting elected, demonizing your political enemies, like the Nixon guy said. It's also for money because, you know, we're talking about, this is 2 to 5% of the global GDP is drugs. 2 to 5%. That's a lot of money. right? So, you know, and where's all the money going? American banks. Weird. Because, you know, if you want to end the war on, if you want to win the war on drugs, tell the banks to stop taking the drug dealer money. Then it's worthless.
Yeah.
You can't pay everything in cash. You know, how much gas and groceries are these drug dealers going to possibly buy? But there you go. So, and
just like one more point. This is such a clear, using drugs is such a good way to racial profile. Like, the policing on crack cocaine versus powder cocaine.
Oh, yes.
It's just, like, insane. There's an insane discrepancy. And obviously, white people use powder cocaine more. And, yeah, no one really cares about that.
No. Because, well, unless they're the part of the anti-war left.
Yeah.
Or black exactly. people. Those are the two enemies of the Nixon administration. And one last one about the war on drugs. According to UN statistics, people charged with drug offenses now constitute an estimated 1 in 5 prisoners worldwide, the vast majority based on personal consumption. So it's just a joke to put people in cages to make money, to win political points. That's what the whole war on drugs is. Now what has it led to? So let's get to the so what. Back to the article. The report centers its proposals firmly in the context of BC's ongoing overdose epidemic. Despite continuous efforts in BC to resolve the overdose crisis and the declaration of a public health emergency, there has been minimal success in stopping the rising death toll since the crisis started. And additional alternative solutions are warranted immediately, it reads. Overdose deaths in the province have become so pervasive there has been a measured decrease in life expectancy. Decrease in life expectancy at birth for all British Columbians. There were 1,510 fatal overdoses in BC in 2018, according to the BC Coroner Service. That compares to 991 deaths in 2016 and 368 in 2014. Wow. Talk about, that's just nuts.
Yeah.
That's nuts. The synthetic opioid fentanyl was associated with 87% of 2018 deaths, up from 15% 5 years earlier. So this is what we get, folks. This is the culmination of really horrible drug policy written by the evil monsters, masters of mankind. When you have people that are there to make a buck writing your drug policy, when you're there to people who are just horrific political ghouls such as Richard Nixon writing drug policy, this is what you get.
Yeah.
This is the logical conclusion of the war on drugs is people, innocent people dying.
Yeah, it's
completely needlessly. It's really sick. It's really sick stuff. Wow. The 1500 number really jumps out at you, huh?
Yeah, I wouldn't have expected that.
And that's a lot of people. BC is not that big of a place to have 1,500 people die. And to be completely honest, I think, you know, we all know people who we've lost because of this. And, you know, who's there to blame? The people in power. There's no one else. As much as people want to blame drug dealers, what a silly, you know, these are middlemen. You know, this is not, you know, the people that put this into practice. It's just, you know, your dealer on the block, unfortunately, you know, although they are the ones that supplied, you know, the drugs to the person, they're just at the bottom of the supply chain.
And it's also like these drug problems are exacerbated by poverty. If it was like a socialist society, everyone had enough food. Everyone had like enough resources to live easily. Drugs would go way down.
Yeah, way down. Why are people? There you go. That's a great question to ask. Why are people even doing drugs? Is it because, you know, everyone's partying 24/7, or it's because people are miserable and depressed? And why are people miserable and depressed? Well, because we have three people. What is it? You know, three people in the United States that have as much wealth as the bottom half. You know, about a dozen people that in the world have as much money as the bottom half of the world. 80% of people live on $10 a day or less. Maybe that's why people use drugs, to escape this horrific hell world reality.
And also, when you are in such a bad situation, it's very hard. Like, it's just so easy to get into drugs.
Absolutely.
And getting off of them is even harder.
Well, with what healthcare would you get off of them? You have no access to healthcare because you're poor. And that's why, you know, maybe giving healthcare and, you know, drug treatment to the highest bidder is not the best way to run a society. So we're going to have to take a short break for commercials, but we'll be right back after that. Stay tuned.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
hardcore heavy metal radio. It'll have you saying, yeah. Tune in every Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Muncie, Musqueam Territory, with my co-host, Nitai.
Hey.
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And now we are going to turn away from the overdose crisis and the decriminalization of possession of drugs in BC, which is a great policy and should be followed because it'll help the 1,510 people that died from opioids last year. We're very supportive of that, the Spencer Latu Show. So it has my endorsement, if that matters to anybody.
And I don't know, just look at all the countries that do it. Just look at the empirical evidence. If for some reason you think this won't work, just look at the empirical evidence on it.
Yeah, look at the evidence. Don't listen to what you heard in your stupid DARE program by that pig that came into your school to tell you about drugs. Yeah, if you can believe it, that they're liars. So moving on to a guy exposing liars and cheats, Julian Assange. This is an article from Truth Dig, a great website. Everyone should go check it out. It is now, you can't get on it because of our last topic that we discussed last week, Russiagate. Because of Russiagate, Truth Dig is now not on the front page of Google because apparently that's quote unquote fake news. And that moral panic was great. So the headline reads, Julian Assange and the criminalization of journalism. So this is written by Marjorie Cohn, a contributor to Truth Dig and Truth Out. Any off the top of your head thoughts on Julian Assange, Nitai?
You don't have to like him. He's done some questionable stuff, but a lot of that can be refuted. But just this is very bad for journalism.
Yes,
he's a whistleblower and. I know, it's just disgusting what happened.
It really is. So imagine the movie The Post, and at the end of the movie in The Post is that the Washington Post goes to jail and gets executed by the United States government. That's basically what Julian Assange is. He just publishes the stuff.
Yeah, he just, he's just like exposing war crimes and no one wants that.
Yeah, and now all the people that, you know, were like, you know, and this is what makes me really, you know, really disturbed by what's going on in our world, because I think, you know, and, you know, tell me if I'm getting too tin foil hatty for you out here, Nita. You can stop me if I'm getting that way. Yeah. But Time Magazine, who was people of the year? Journalists, right? You know, they do the tongue bath to Jamal Khashoggi, you know, which is sad. Obviously, he got bones, you know, got hacked up into a bajillion pieces in the embassy. I'm not trying to diminish that at all. It's really terrible. However, you know, what kind of truth of power was he speaking to? You know, Saudi Arabia? Was he exposing Saudi Arabia as a screwed up country? Wow, that's great. Thanks for exposing that. I could have looked that up any time of the week. You saw mainstream media.
Yeah.
What was Julian Assange exposing? Was Julian Assange even mentioned in that Time article? No.
Yeah, and like Julian Assange and WikiLeaks has just been like, it's just increased like government transparency a lot. And I know this should be the standard of journalism.
Yet, how many journalists are going to bat for this guy?
Like, Chomsky called him the most dangerous man in the world.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's badass. I would love to be called the most dangerous man in the world by Chomsky. That's when you know you're onto something. Yeah, how many media outlets are even going to bat for this guy? Glenn Greenwald in The Intercept?
Everything I saw from, like, any like major corporation is talking about how he's a Russian puppet.
Exactly, he's a Russian agent. All my liberal friends say he's a Russian agent. In fact, his indictment has nothing to do with Russia at all.
I also saw people call him a crypto fascist. So,
what does that even mean?
I don't know how you can call him a fascist.
Oh yeah,
because
Putin is a fascist. Yeah, yeah. Oh, and that was Neera Tanden. Yeah, fascists look after their own. Yeah, God, Neera Tanden is scum of the earth. So to the article here. After living under a grant of asylum in London's Ecuadorian embassy for nearly 7 years, WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange was forcibly ejected and arrested by British police on April 11th. Ecuador's president, Lenin Moreno, accused Assange of repeated violations to international conventions and daily life protocols after an anonymous source revealed the INA papers, a dossier that implicated Moreno in money laundering and contained personal photos of his family. WikiLeaks tweeted about it but denied any connection to the hacking. Do you think that's what did it? Do you think Lenin Moreno ejected Assange after WikiLeaks tweeted about Moreno and his money laundering? Do you think that might have had something to do with it?
Hard to say.
Conflict of interest, maybe? That's how bad the story is. It's just, it gets worse, folks. It gets way worse. Rafael Correa, who was president of Ecuador until 2017, had granted Assange asylum in 2012 to protect him from extradition to the United States to answer for WikiLeaks' publication of evidence of U.S. war crimes. Folks, there it is. Let's center that in the idea. So whenever you think about Julian Assange, don't think about Julian Assange. Yeah. Replace Julian Assange in your mind with U.S. war crimes, because that's what's really on trial here, is the exposition of U.S. war crimes. That's what Julian Assange as a person represents. That's why they try to center, the mainstream media at least, is trying to center Julian Assange's character that they spent about a decade trying to diminish anyway. His character assassination has been going on for years. So that's why they try to do that, because the U.S. war crimes are just so brutal.
Yeah.
So that they can't talk about them. Anyways, Ecuador's foreign minister at the time, Ricardo Patino, said that without his protection, Assange could suffer political persecution or extradition to the United States, where he might face the death penalty. Yes, folks, they're going to kill a journalist.
What they technically said is, like, when the UK took him, like, they won't sentence him to death, but who knows?
Who knows what the US would do to him?
Yeah.
The United Kingdom won't. Thank God, UK. We'll just send him to the United States. We'll put him in Gitmo. In 2010, WikiLeaks published classified documentation of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, which Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning had provided. It included the collateral murder video that showed U.S. soldiers in an Army helicopter gunship kill 12 unarmed civilians walking down a street in Baghdad.
Some of them were journalists.
Yes. There was Reuters journalists there that the U.S. Army killed, and they laughed about it.
Yeah.
Went for what they called a double tap, which is where they shoot when the humanitarian services arrive and they kill them too.
Shot a Jeep that had children in it.
Yeah, and this is just the helicopter shooting people.
Yeah.
We are not even touching the drone stuff, which is a whole other, you know, bag of, you know, of goodies there. And folks, this is what I think is the most disturbing thing, and what people, you know, and you know, I may go on a tangent about nonviolence here, but this is the world. When people say, like, oh, I don't like violence, well, I'm like, then don't live in the United States. Don't live in Canada, because this is what we are.
Yeah.
This is what this is all built on. You know, this horrible decadence that we live in is because of these people. We wouldn't have this without killing them.
Yeah.
So when all the people decry violence, you know, which is just mostly burning trash cans in Ferguson, which is for whatever reason violence, but they can't deal with the unarmed civilians, the people in wedding parties, the journalists murdered.
It doesn't affect them.
No. It doesn't affect me personally, so it never happened.
Yeah.
Sweden investigated Assange in fall 2010 for allegations of sexual assault, which is not true, and I can get to that later.
If I remember, like, two of the three women dropped the charges, and I think he said that he would testify as long as they wouldn't extradite him to the U.S.
Exactly. Assange was living in Britain at the time. Sweden issued an extradition warrant so Assange could face questioning about the investigation in Sweden. Assange fought extradition but lost in Britain's Supreme Court in 2012. He sought and received refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So, like Nitai was saying, he said he would go in for questioning, but obviously, you know, with the assurances that he would not be extradited, of course they would never give that to him. The women that came forward also said that the cops pressured them to say it. So, I mean, what's up with that? You know, you can see the court documents for yourselves, folks. You know, I got the documents. That's my Alex Jones impersonation. But you can read it yourself. You know, I'm not telling you how to feel about Julian Assange, but just know that this whole sexual assault smear about him that comes up every single time you see him.
Yeah.
Any like, you know, neo-lib kind of person or rad-lib kind of person.
I even see the same people who defended Kavanaugh be against him for the same... For like the rape.
Wow. Allegations.
Yeah.
That's quite the mental gymnastic right there. Wow. Leaps and bounds mentally to do that stuff. In spite of pressure from the British government in 2012, Korea granted asylum to Assange, who remained in the Ecuadorian embassy ever since. Sweden dropped its investigation of Assange in 2017. So the investigation's over.
Yeah.
So now that that's gone, now it's really obvious what this is all about, which is the war crimes.
Yeah.
And so Trump, you know, I'm going to. Trump is, you know, he. And I guess we kind of got to deal with this. So the DNC, the Podesta emails.
Yeah.
Did it hurt Hillary Clinton? Yes.
Yeah.
Did what Hillary Clinton do in said emails, you know, was that really horrible? Yeah. Why do we never talk about that?
But like, I don't know. The main thing that came from those emails is Pizzagate.
Well, I mean, they also revealed a lot of other interesting things. Did you see the stuff about cheating Bernie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
The only thing I see from Hillary's emails that, like, ever come up anymore is Pizzagate and, like, QAnon.
Yeah, and that's really, really great that you point that out, because I think for the reactionary right, all they want to talk about is really stupid conspiracy theories. And rather than dealing with, you know, and like they like to bash the DNC for being, you know, a corrupt organization, yet you vote for Republicans, so they're only that times 20.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's not really, it's pretty obvious, you know, it's not really, you know, too hard to understand as a quote unquote conspiracy theory. Basically, you know, the DNC, the Democratic Party, as we're going to get to later in the broadcast, it's a counter-revolutionary party that is in charge of crushing very moderate people. A European centrist, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
He's not, you know, people pretend he's like this loopy radical.
He's like far left in the U.S.
Yeah. He's far left in the United States. Center, I wouldn't even say center left in Europe.
Yeah, and like I think like almost
Theresa May is barely to the right of Bernie Sanders, which is, that says something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where we're at here. And now the Trump administration. So while Trump tweeted about WikiLeaks, you know, the entire campaign trail talking about how great WikiLeaks is, now we turn to them turning on Assange. So I don't know all the details. This is obviously a massive case with a lot of moving parts to it, and I don't know exactly the relationship. A lot of people say he was, you know, a Trump puppet or worked with the Trump administration. Well, I really don't. I, as smart of a guy as Julian Assange is, I would hope that he would know better to not trust Donald Trump.
But I don't care. It's increased government transparency, even if he was
I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you on that. Yeah. Even if he's a quote-unquote Russian puppet, like, forget all that. I'm just saying, if, as a person, like, why would you trust this guy? Yeah. Because, you know, what I'm going to say next is, you know, this is the really, you know, unfortunate thing. So, in 2017, then-CIA director Mike Pompeo said, WikiLeaks walks like a hostile intelligence service and talks like a hostile intelligence service. So, you know, if Assange did trust Trump at any point, what did that, like...
Yeah.
Not a good place to be, because now look what's happening. Under Trump, you're, you know, probably going to get executed. So an indictment filed on March 6, 2018 in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia charges Assange under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It alleges he was a part of a conspiracy to access a computer without authorization in order to obtain classified information that could be used to the injury of the United States. Assange faces 5 years of prison if convicted. Could be used. Could be used to the injury of the United States? How about to the injury of the 12 innocent people that were murdered, and the journalists and the kids and the entire country of Iraq and the creation of ISIS?
Yeah.
It's hard. Bad. It's bad. Yeah. This is, yeah. Okay, so, you know, now, and so what, right? Oh, this is just one other victim of the U.S. empire, they say. Well, look at this. Assange's indictment will chill freedom of the press. Assange's prosecution is unprecedented. The Justice Department has never charged journalists with violating the law for doing their jobs.
Because he wasn't prosecuted as a journalist. He was prosecuted as a hacker under the single charge of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. Assange, who did not possess a security clearance or need to know, was not authorized to receive classified material from the United States.
So what you're describing basically would then put the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg, the Washington Post, would put them in jail. That puts them in the same boat, people. Yeah, so exactly. These people that we lionized and are very, you know, that we're cheerleaders for, the logical conclusion is that, you know, and once you apply it to Assange, you basically set the precedent that anyone that publishes anything that's, you know, they're not on a need to know basis could be executed.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we bash Saudi Arabia for press freedom. We're turning into, you know, the United States is basically Saudi Arabia with a few more steps.
Land of the free.
Land of the free. Home of the brave. ACLU's Ben Wisner cautioned that prosecuting Assange would set an especially dangerous precedent for U.S. journalists who routinely violate foreign secrecy laws to deliver information vital to the public's interest. He added that while there is no First Amendment right to crack a government password, this indictment characterizes as part of a criminal conspiracy the routine and protected activities journalists often engage in as part of their daily job, such as encouraging a source to provide more information.
It's okay to be a whistleblower for any country except the U.S.
Yeah, if you blow the whistle, blowing the whistle on Russia, great. Yeah. You got a Pulitzer Prize. Blowing the whistle on the United States, and you lose your life.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is the ACLU here, folks. So this is not, you know, once again, this is not Lenin on on Julian Assange. This is not the far left on Julian Assange. This is pretty, these are the same people that fought for the right of the Charlottesville protesters, okay? Yeah. So, you know, can anyone in the mainstream media stand up for Assange? No, everyone's just saying, oh, he's not a real journalist. Do you need to go to journalism school to be a journalist? Do you need a journalism badge to be a journalist? Or do you just have to toe, you know, the U.S. Empire's line to be a journalist?
Yeah, like, compared to anyone else recently, he's done so much for journalism. Just how can you not call him one?
Yeah, well, I think that's because, you know, we're entering this, you know, this word is getting over. This Orwellian is turning Orwellian.
I hate people who use Orwellian because they use it as, like, against socialism, and it's just like, Orwell was a socialist.
Yeah, he just, you know, maybe disagreed with a few things that Stalin did. But, you know, who hasn't? Who hasn't these days? But, yeah, the word itself, Orwellian, is just kind of being used for everything Trump does.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's just more like the system itself.
I also see it against the left for, like, political correctness.
Oh, God.
And, like, when we're trying to control what people think. So, yeah.
Yeah, when you can't even read Orwell. I think the term journalist is taking an Orwellian turn, where journalist means, you know, it's supposed to mean truth teller. It's supposed to mean person, you know, bringing issues to the fore, you know, to the front of, you know, discussion. But instead of turning into, you know, who can be the most palatable to power. Yeah. So it's like the opposite of what a journalist is supposed to be is now what a journalist is supposed to be.
Yeah, exactly. Like whatever helps the government.
Yeah, whatever helps power. And you know, one specific government, you know, like NATO governments, you know, Five Eyes governments. It's not the other governments. You know, if you can talk as much smack about China, Russia, Iran as you want to, you're a hero. Talk smack about the United States. Or not even talk smack. Tell the truth about the United States. Show people where every half of every dollar of their tax money goes to. What are you paying for? Oh, yeah, the murder of journalists and civilians.
Does, like, anyone in the U.S. care anymore? Like, this is, like, we keep seeing more and more files of awful things they did, and then, I don't know, I don't see enough outrage about it.
No, I think, I also think that people are just so inundated. I think that this is a long project. Like, these people, you know, I know they don't get around in smoke-filled rooms and plan this stuff, but, you know, the media, and, you know, I always try to think about manufacturing consent, and I think this is, you know, filter four, flack, to its, you know, most extreme end. So when you really, and you know, I credit Assange with ending the Iraq War. You know, the public outrage that came out after that video and exposing, like, what's going on. You know, they're not fighting terror. They're just killing random people in the street.
Yeah.
Innocent people, terrorizing them. And they created ISIS. And that is what ended the Iraq War. And that took a lot of money out of Raytheon. You know, that took a lot of money out of Lockheed Martin. That took a lot of money out of Boeing. It took a lot of money out of all the oil companies making a buck off this war. And that is what's, you know, and what do you do when you cost the empire? You pay with your life. You know, you pay with blood. We're going to have to take a short break for commercials, but we'll be right back after that.
All right. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does this make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we... You're not even gonna last. Hey.
Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France, Montreal. What the f***?
It's the script. I couldn't even. What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that, because even a fucking elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR production department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
What's up, everybody? You're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Unceded Musqueam Territory and UBC's Point Grey campus. I'm with my co-host, Nitai.
Yeah, hi.
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And so we're wrapping up our discussion of Julian Assange. And, you know, Julian Assange, what was the great crime that he did? You know, he, according to liberals, got Trump elected. And how do you get Trump elected? Well, just expose to people how the DNC really works. And what the DNC is a counter-revolutionary party that is there to crush the most mild of, and I say this, you know, knowing what the political climate of the United States is, the most mild of, you know, of deviations. You know, we go from, you know, horrible liberalism into, you know, moderately better social democracy, which is all that Bernie Sanders is really saying.
You also have to show that they have an underground pedophilia ring.
Yeah, yeah. The Pizzagate stuff is unfortunate, but that's what happens when the right wing gets their hands on things. They just turn the best things into the worst things really quickly. So the DNC. So we're, you know, Joe Biden just announced. Oh. We now have a field of 20 candidates, 20 candidates for 2020. So why is this happening? We're not going to break down all the candidates, but, you know, I just want to start off our discussion with, you know, a little bit of provocative, you know, crystal ball gazing. I think that since the DNC has been so discredited, they've had to head fake towards democracy. So, you know, when that lawsuit in Florida that people said was going to go nowhere really exposed, I think, in court, a really important point about the Democratic Party. And this is, you know, this is kind of me trying to convert people who really believe in electoralism, that the DNC flat out said that it doesn't, it's a corporation, doesn't have to abide by any democratic principles. It literally is, you know, a dino, Democrat name only, the entire organization.
Even if there was another, like a really good party, they still can't change anything through the electoral politics.
And this is why, because, you know, like George Carlin said, it's one big club and you ain't in it. Yeah. And to that point, so let's take the case study of Bernie Sanders. So Bernie Sanders, once again, a centrist in European politics. This guy is not, you know, as much as, you know, North American media pretends that he's a radical, that he's like the coming up. I wish he was said, you know, workers seize the means of production, workers of the world unite. That'd be great.
Yeah.
That would be amazing. Not even close to that.
Yeah.
I don't think he's even committed to canceling student debt. That's only Elizabeth Warren so far. So before I get too distracted about how centrist Bernie is, still love Bernie. Bernie or bust. I'm a Bernie bro through and through. Bernie's what got me into politics, you know?
And, like, you have to realize, like,
he's the best candidate.
Yeah, he won't change anything, but at least he'll help the working class a bit.
And if the working class decides to rise up against, you know, with Bernie in the White House, which, you know, I'm going to explain why he will never get there. But hypothetically, this is what I say to the people. And as someone who rejects electoralism, this is my thinking. So we have Bernie Sanders in office, and let's say that the United States Empire decides they want to destroy Iran, you know, which is what looks like they're gearing up to do. And there's a massive anti-war protest outside the White House, which there would never be because people are so inundated with media. But hypothetically, say that there's one happening. With Bernie could maybe listen.
Yeah.
If it's Trump, the National Guard's going to come and start shooting people. So that is why, you know, to all the people that really believe in social bottom-up change, which I believe in as well, you do not want a proto-fascist or an extreme right-winger or somebody who's, you know, has right-wing militia mobs kind of roaming the streets like Trump in office because it only emboldens them. So from that vantage point, I'm not saying go out there and campaign for Bernie, but, and once again, you're not going to be able to, and we're going to get to that soon. But, you know, think about it at least for a second, who you'd rather have in the White House.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think we're all in agreement that Bernie's better than Trump, you know?
Like, he probably won't make things worse for the poor people.
Things will get worse. They will.
Yeah, but not like...
He won't intentionally make things worse.
Or he won't make it as bad as Trump would.
True. Okay, so this is why Bernie will not be able to run for president. So hot take, you know, let's find out where I am next year. If someone might play this back for me, I'll probably play it back for myself and laugh at myself if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. So we have 20 candidates in the race, okay? 20 people in the primary. Actually, I'm running in the primary now. There's 21. kidding. Not saying it's bad to have 20 candidates. I think it's great that Tulsi Gabbard's in it, and I think that our, you know, yours and mine personal favorite in the race,
Gravel Gang,
or die. I will get to Mike Gravel soon. Someone said it was Mike Gravel, and I was like,
oh yeah, I think it is. I was listening to his like campaign thing.
Is it actually Mike Gravel?
Yeah, I think it's Gravel.
Okay, but... no, Gravel Gang.
Yeah,
Gravel Gang, Graveler. shows out Pokemon. Okay, so the reason why Bernie's going to lose, Bernie's not even going to get a chance to run for president is because
the gravel's going to win.
Yeah, well, first of all, Mike Gravel's going to win. Second of all, that's my first theory. Second is 20 people are in the race. And the reason why they did this is because, and you know, we have to go back to 2016, which was the major criticism from people saying, hey, the Democratic Party isn't Democratic. What's with all these superdelegates? So what is a superdelegate? Yeah. A delegate is a regular delegate, is an elected, you know, official that people, you know, they vote in the primary, and then the delegates vote based on their constituents. You know, like a normal functioning, normal democracy. What is a superdelegate? Well, that's all the DNC insiders. That's the think tank people, the military contractors, the big businesses.
They just arbitrarily pick it.
Yep. It's whoever the DNC chair picks to be in their, you know, oligarchy. And these people have, you know, thousands. I think it's crazy how many delegate votes they represent. So this completely undemocratic, you know, thing within the Democratic Party, superdelegates. People got really mad because there's people voting against delegates that were supposed to vote for Bernie, or people who won in their state. So, such as in Indiana, Bernie won the primary,
Bernie only lost because of the superdelegates.
Yeah, and then, you know, and even regular delegates were voting against, you know, the will of the state. So Bernie would win in Indiana, yet the Indiana superdelegates would vote against Bernie. So what's going on? So that's why, you know, the Bernie bros united, shout out Bernie bros, and demanded Bernie gals, and I've heard this other one, Sanders sisses.
Haven't.
Yeah, and now we need Bernie, non-binary Bernie fans. There you go. We got them all. And the superdelegates would vote, you know, based on the interest of capital. They would just vote, you know, whatever the establishment candidates, which is why Hillary Clinton was a candidate, and they picked the only person that could possibly lose to Trump. Now, because of that disaster, they've moved the superdelegates. They haven't gotten rid of them because that would be crazy. Imagine having the Democratic Party, you know, be an actual democracy. That's just crazy, Nita.
Imagine people having a say in their government.
Oh, why? Why would we have that? It would be mob rule, whatever that means. Yeah, insane. You know, whatever is good for most people is what the government wants. So rather than getting rid of the superdelegates, which is what everybody wanted, they just moved the superdelegates to the second ballot. So what's the first ballot? The first ballot is the 20 freaking primary candidates that are running on. So, you know, and the only way to get, you know, if Bernie was to win the first ballot, he'll have to win a majority. So how are you going to do that with 20 people in it, including Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg? Is Andrew Yang running as a Democratic candidate?
I thought he was an independent.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
But there's just a million of them.
Yeah, just.
And that is what I think the play is here, folks. I think that's what the play is. It's to deny.
No, Democratic presidential candidate.
Everybody. Yeah. Everybody. And I think that's what the play is here, is to load up the first ballot with so many people that Bernie cannot win on the first ballot, which is where there's no superdelegates, then move to the second ballot where the superdelegates will be, once again, we'll check it in a year, and they're just going to vote for the most establishment candidate, which I think will be Kamala Harris. Or
Biden.
You think it's going to be Biden? I don't think Biden. I think Biden's got too many Me Too problems, but that's another.
Yeah, but like, I don't know. People were obsessed with Obama and he's like the vice president. He'll just be another Obama, just like more right wing.
Do you think that's the establishment pick? Because I think the establishment pick is Harris. Oh, Booker. It could be Booker. Oh, it's hard to tell.
I know. Beto O'Rourke was like surprising.
Oh, God. Don't remind me of Beto. Yeah. So, you know, obviously we try not to talk too much like really silly political theater stuff because it really is just kabuki theater.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Not only does it not matter, but I just think it's a very interesting, you know, discussion to have about, you know, how rigged the DNC is and how they're going to screw over Bernie again. And, you know, once again, to all the people who really believe in electoralism and think that, you know, your vote every 4 years really matters so much, why are they taking away Bernie off the ballot? You know, what's up with that?
I once saw a liberal saying, like, someone was complaining they were too radical, and the way they want to change the world, like, someone asked, like, oh, how can we change this? They said, vote.
Wow.
Yeah.
When the political imagination's been stolen by capital.
Those are the leftists.
Yeah, those are the crazy radicals. I'm too radical. I want to vote. Holy shit.
Cultural Marxism.
Yeah, cultural Marxism intensifies. Okay, so, and while we're on the topic of Democratic candidates, Nitai, you've done some oppo research for us.
Yeah, okay.
Who'd you like to discuss first?
Okay, I think Kamala Harris is just hilarious.
Okay, why is Kamala Harris hilarious?
Okay, this is amazing. Both of her parents were civil rights activists. her dad was a Marxist professor, and she turns around and becomes a cop.
How does that happen? Like, you'd think she'd be a red diaper baby.
Like, her parents must be so disappointed in her.
Yeah, she's become an agent of the state.
Yeah,
so.
Everything they fought against.
Kamala Harris is, and this is, people say this is not Kamala Harris saying it, but, you know, I really believe it was. This is, according to, you know, her, it's Kamala Harris's office said this, was the reason why she couldn't let out more California prisoners was because... the prison labor supply would be lost.
Literal slave labor.
Yeah, and ironic enough that she is black, yeah, and she uses these people to fight the California wildfires,
yeah,
for less than $1 an hour. So that's Kamala Harris.
She actually has a bit of an interesting track record. She has like some very like stupid conservative policies, but she's also gone a few steps in the right direction before. Like when she was still working in office before she ran for president, she actually had this program where nonviolent offenders would, like, instead of going to the jail, they would get a high school degree and try to get them into work, which I think is exactly what the system needs.
Yes, you would think after all those, you know, people she put in there for low-level drug offenses, she would have learned. Okay, so she ruined a few thousand people's lives, but then she finally got on the right track. And
but she goes back and forth on it all the time.
Yeah, like, yeah.
She's... some good policies and some really bad ones.
And I saw this debate about voting where, you know, obviously, shout out Bernie. Bernie had a great point about, you know, should felons be able to vote? Of course, felons are human beings. What a stupid idea.
They live in the state.
Does the politics not affect their lives?
And, like, they just want...
what does democracy mean to you?
They just want to block as many black votes as possible.
Yeah, so, and once again, bringing us back to our previous segment on the war on drugs. So, you know, 1 in 5 people, half of people in American prisons are there for without even harming another human being.
Yeah.
Nonviolent, nothing to do with violence. You know,
like there's still a ton of people who are like just for possession of weed.
Yeah,
yeah,
a joint.
Yeah,
a joint.
And like it's been like when you control for socioeconomic status, black people are still disproportionately sentenced for like possession of marijuana.
So it's not just poor people; it's specifically black people. Yeah. Okay, so great. So we disenfranchise black people even more than they already have been. And so, and now I want to talk about another candidate, Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg?
He just like came.
Mayor Pete.
He just came here like out of nowhere. I knew nothing about him, and then I just saw this stupid liberal like saying how great he was.
Yeah, there you go. And that's what it is when your horrible liberal friends on Facebook are posting about somebody. I saw liberals cheering on Joe Biden, announcing we'll get to Joe soon. So let's. Mayor Pete, so we're talking about voting rights. Mayor Pete, you know, believes that Mayor Pete really believes that people who lost their who go to jail lose their right to vote because they go to jail. Mayor Pete also thinks that they live in Saudi Arabia or something.
Like, and the only reason I see him getting popular, like the only reason he was popular was the media, and he's like a gay Christian.
Yeah, what's up with that?
And like, and. When identity politics get too far out of hand.
Yeah, he's a great case study. When identity, it's just like juxtaposing like identity to cover up like horrible conservative values. Yeah. Now, let's talk about the antithesis of identity politics. Joe Biden. Joe's got a Me Too problem.
Yeah.
He touches women really inappropriately. That's just weird. It looks really creepy.
Yeah, there's a lot of memes about it.
Yeah, it's really gross. I mean, like, reactionaries are jumping all over it, which is ironic because they're the biggest Me Too decriers, yet they love it now because it fits their political...
war on men.
Yeah, the war... yeah, so there's that. He voted for the Iraq War.
Yeah.
Worst crisis of the 21st century.
Like, he's just, like, a slightly more left-wing Donald Trump, but the thing is, he's respectable.
Yeah, he's that's very well said. Yeah, he is the respectable version of Donald Trump. He says the quiet parts quiet. You know, he doesn't openly embrace white nationalists. And that's about it.
Yeah.
I don't... Yeah, like, what else does he disagree
like,
on?
Even... I know, he's like more right-wing than Obama. So.
Oh, far right. He was a crime and punishment guy. He wanted people... He kept holding hearings on drugs and crime and...
Like, he'd basically do everything Trump did, except maybe, like, not pull out of Afghanistan, and his tax breaks wouldn't be as big.
Yeah, I don't think he would have been touting the tax plan as well, as loudly as him.
Yeah. I could still see it happening, just not as...
Yeah, not as intense. Yeah. So, okay. Beto O'Rourke. You said creation of the media by Pete Buttigieg. Well, look at Beto O'Rourke.
Like,
he launched his entire campaign on the cover of Vanity Fair.
Yeah, like, he has no policy.
None. And if you go to his website, they have a store there before his policies. I'm going to go on Beto O'Rourke website right now, and I'll report back. I'm doing some big J journalism, doing more journalism than most CNN people do. A lot less than a real hero, Julian Assange, but a lot more than, you know, people like Chuck Todd.
He's basically just Trudeau.
Beto? Yeah, a very just sweaty, like, Trudeau.
I know, like, attractive young white guy.
Young quotations. Okay, so now he does have a vision for America. So let's look at his vision. He has democracy, income inequality, and equality. Very fascinating.
Wait, okay, I didn't realize he's 46 years old.
Yeah, he looks very good for 40. Okay, yeah. On healthcare. I was hoping to read on contradiction. So if we believe in universal guaranteed high-quality health care, this is from the Beto O'Rourke website. We are now a Beto or Bust podcast, radio show. So if we believe in universal guaranteed high-quality health care because we see the consequences to our fellow Americans who go without, then let us come together around a policy that prioritizes affordability. Affordability. Okay, we're waiting for access.
The Democratic Party still isn't on Medicare for All?
No, he's not. No, there's no Medicare for All here. No, okay. Here, this means, affordability of prescription drugs lowers the cost of premiums. So not he's going to keep health insurance. The only country in the world that has health insurance, people.
Only, like, developed.
Yeah, the only developed country that has health insurance. When the where one of the largest providers of mental health care services is our county jail system, a country where he doesn't say anything. Oh, that universal health care means everyone gets primary health care, mental health care, and universal also means that every woman makes her own decisions about her own body. Okay. So nowhere in there is Medicare for All. Yeah. We can give every American and every business the choice to enroll in Medicare without eliminating plans that many Americans like for their families because they work for their families.
This will just be like another ACA.
Well, or with a public option.
Yeah.
Which he doesn't even say public option, so it might just be ACA the same way.
And after, like, if he gets in, it'll just be another Republican after him that defunds it.
Oh, here's a good one. Education. If we believe in an economy that works for all, then let us invest in a world-class pre-K through 12 public education system and ensure that we are paying our educators a living wage. A living wage for teachers? You go to university and teaching school and you get a living wage.
It's depressing that that's like...
That's good education policy.
Yeah.
Let's graduate young women and men from high school who are career-ready as well as college-ready, able to pursue debt-free higher education or a job that provides purpose and a real paycheck. Wow. That is the worst education. Oh, that I'm logging out.
Like, I don't know, just depressing that that's like way better than what they have now.
That's somehow a step up, which is good. Okay, so now we've talked about. Oh, we'll take a short break for commercials, and then we'll come back and we'll discuss a real candidate for America, folks. We'll be.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Hey folks, the Pride Collective at UBC is an AMS resource group for LGBTQ+ folks. All our events and resources are free, so you should check us out on Facebook or come to Nest 2103 and say hi. We have so many fun events every week.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latchey Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Musqueam, Musqueam territory. I'm with my co-host, Nitai.
Hey.
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And so we're going to check out a real candidate that's not named Bernie Sanders. And honestly, you know, I'm going to shout out Elizabeth Warren. I think she's great, too.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't be mad. I wouldn't be excited.
And, like, she seems, like, around on par with Bernie. She kind of explains how she's going to do things a bit more, but she has, like, 4% of the vote.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's way better than everyone else. I'd say number one, Bernie, number two, Elizabeth Warren, and, you know, on actually, sorry, number two, Bernie, number three, Elizabeth Warren. Yeah. And let's get to number one. So let's play this awesome campaign video, and we'll introduce our great candidate.
But let's maybe bring up the topic of the day, which is the Green New Deal.
How much will this cost? That's unclear. How will we pay for it? Unknown.
It's not realistic.
Because there's no way to pay for it.
It's immoral.
The younger generation now tells me how tough things are. Give me a break.
That was Biden.
I have no empathy.
I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons.
I think Medicare for All is one of the possible paths.
Beta Roar.
So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy.
Kamala Harris.
A little controversial in San Francisco.
He did ask you yes or no. Would you support free college for all?
I am not for free four-year college for all. No.
I'm so excited. Man shakes head.
Human beings are being killed as I speak to you tonight. Killed as a direct result of policy decisions we as a body have made.
This approach of war on drugs has not succeeded. We've spent billions of dollars on it.
And we fill up our prisons to the point where we're the embarrassment of the world. We're supposed to be a democracy. We've got more people in prison, 2.3 million people in prison.
We spend more as a nation on defense than all the rest of the world put together.
This whole nation should be a sanctuary for the world. I'm ashamed as an American to be building a fence on our southern border. That's not the America that I fought for.
Our soldiers died in Vietnam in vain. You can now, John, go to Hanoi and get a Baskin-Robbins ice cream cone.
Why do they hate us so in so many places around the world?
Because we kill so many people wantonly.
Oh, Joe, I'll include you too. You have a certain arrogance. You wanna tell the Iraqis how to run their country.
And we can get off of gasoline in 5 years, and we can get off of carbon in 10 years. All we gotta do is want to do it.
Just play get out. It's their country. They're asking us to leave, and we insist on staying there.
The military-industrial complex not only controls our government lock, stock, and barrel, but they control our culture.
America needs a voice for justice. Help Mike Gravel get to the debates to be that voice. Mike needs 65,000 donations to be part of the debates. Donate as little as $1.
It's time to make some waves for change. I'm Mike Gravel, and I'm running for president.
Wow.
Gravel 2020.
Gravel 2020.
Gravel Why can't gang. Every 88-year-old be that cool?
When I'm 88, I want to be that cool. That's a goal. Wow. And that video on YouTube is titled Rock 2.0, Mike Gravel 2020. If you go to mikegravel.org, it's mikegravel.org. It starts out with war. What is it good for? And there is a running meter. Check this out. That is $5 trillion, $435 billion, $580 million, we're almost at $600,000 already, and it's going into wow, this is really fun to watch. Just the amount of money that's so it's over $5 trillion spent on regime quote unquote regime change wars since 2001. That's what Mike Gravel's website has first and foremost, and I think that's a very important thing that Mike is centering, which is what is causing all the problems in the world. What's causing climate catastrophe? War. What's causing income inequality? War.
What? Why doesn't the U.S. have universal health care?
They're spending half of every tax dollar on war. You know, why is Venezuela being talked about regime change? Because they want more war.
They just want more the oil.
Yeah, and why is, and John Bolton said it, it's not just us, okay? He said it straight out. He's like, oh, they got a lot of oil. Donald Trump said it would be great if we could take their oil. Donald Trump's critique of the Iraq war didn't take their oil. So why are all these problems happening? War. And I'm glad that there's a presidential candidate, even though this is an interesting presidential debate, presidential candidate whose Twitter account is absolute fire.
Oh, his Twitter account is managed by two teenagers, and both of them are Chapo Trap House listeners. They're that's like one of the biggest leftist podcasts.
Yeah, shout out Chapo. It's great how podcasts can radicalize a youth, and now Mike Gravel's Twitter account is absolute fire. Here's a great one. This is a tweet from Mike Gravel. Our 420 fundraiser to end the war on drugs begins at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Only opportunity to get official Pentagon rolling paper, supplies limited. Link will be posted at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Wow, I can't believe I missed that. And it's a picture of rolling papers to say Pentagon papers, cut military spending in half, end the war on drugs, Gravel 2020. So hopefully there's some left over, because I would love to get my hands on some of those and burn one for Mike 2020, Gravel 2020. $5 trillion, what's that enough money for? That's enough to cover the full cost of tuition for every person wishing to enroll in the community college in the United States. Amazing. And I guess who's not going to win the U.S. presidency? I want to give my dollar for Gravel, because I want to see him on the debate stage. Do you think he's going to bring up the immortal science of Marxism-Leninism on stage?
I really hope so. But what I've heard from these, that like they can actually change the rules of who's allowed to debate, so they could just make it like the top 15 candidates or something.
They can make it the top 60 candidates.
Yeah, they can just kind of change it. So
that's a big letdown, because I would love to see Mike Gravel up there and debate imperialism with the pigs of the United States.
Maybe we can figure out what Beto believes in.
Yeah, Beto. Do you think they'll have a stump or a table for him to stand on? Yeah,
I hope so.
The best meme I saw about Beto O'Rourke, and memes really are the best way to
like,
know.
They're literal propaganda. Like, they're very effective,
and it works on me, because there was one about Beto O'Rourke that said, you know, stand on something especially when you stand for nothing, or something to that effect. And I was like, you know what, that really sums up Beto O'Rourke in a nutshell.
Like, half of my political opinions are from memes.
If I can't meme it, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
If I can't explain to you complicated issues through memes, then it's not worth, especially that butterfly meme.
Oh, yeah, like, how can I know it's true?
Yeah, if it's not memeable, it's not real. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for engaging in our really high-level discussion about memes and Mike Gravel. We're on the air every Thursday, 6 to 7:30. Nitai, thank you so much for coming in. This is a great discussion. I hope to have you back. Make sure to bring lots of memes to describe on air for people. Okay. There's going to be more great programming from CITR coming up, so stay tuned for some of that. And anything you want to say about you want to plug the SJC for a second there?
Yeah, sure. Right now, UBC has these resource groups. They're AMS sponsored, and there's six of them. But the one that I'm a part of is the Social Justice Center. We try to promote social justice and usually fight the university. And
power to the people.
Yeah, so we might not have events anytime soon, but in September you should keep an eye out.
Where can people find the Social Justice Center?
The Social Justice Center is on the second floor of the Nest, I think room 2102.
Yeah, it's in the corner. It's in the corner, folks. Go check it out. Great place. Great people. That's where I got to meet Nitai and hang out with some awesome people and talk some great politics. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. Check us out on Apple, iTunes, Podcast, Spencer Latu Show, and we're out.